Accession number 11109, Reel 2.
Mr. Proud, Reel 2.
There were two or three unpleasant occasions in which Arabs had to be forcibly evicted from land bought by Jewish settlers. One in particular is a place called Wadi Hawarith, between Tel Aviv and Netanya. The Arabs concerned were landless people who had been accustomed to squatting on the land or working as tenant farmers, not landowners themselves.
Were you present?
No.
So I'd ask you this question about comparing Jerusalem and Jaffa with regard to the Arab revolt. Was it just a question of the fact that you were in Jerusalem later on in 38 as compared with 36, or were there genuine geographical or social differences?
Because Jerusalem was in the mountain country of Judea, it was surrounded by hostile, what one might call hostile territory, occupied by rural Arabs who were prepared to go out and operate with the gangs. And then the old city of Jerusalem itself, with the famous Dome of the Rock and the Al-Masjid al-Aqsa, the second biggest mosque, they were all under the influence of Haji Amin al-Husseini and the other extreme religious clerics at the time. So there was constant agitation taking place inside Jerusalem.
Which did you prefer being in yourself, from your own personal point of view, Jerusalem or Jaffa?
Well, Jaffa was where I was posted in the first instance, but in the course of my service, more than half my time was spent in Jerusalem in three main stages. I didn't do 8 years continuously in Jerusalem, but I was there for approximately 8 years altogether. So I came to like Jerusalem.
During the war itself, what were the kind of problems, apart from enemy aliens, that were created for you as a
Well, shortly after the outbreak of war, I was moved out of CID headquarters because the duty post I had been filling was upgraded in rank, but it was given to another officer. And I was moved out to Samaria district, where the main Arab revolt had taken place. And I was in charge of the district CID there, and I was primarily concerned with basic CID and political work, mopping up the remnants of the Arab gangs, and the odd individual man who's still on the run. And then it was a question of concentrating very largely on the Jewish area down on the coastline, because one was faced with the problems of Jewish illegal immigration onto the beaches, and young members of the Jewish community being involved in the terrorist organizations. We were being fed with a certain amount of information coming up from CID headquarters, and possibly inspired, I think, from Jewish sources, that at any time another Arab rebellion was going to break out in the hills. I was always in the impression that was merely to try and divert our attentions into the hills and away from the coast. My own view was we need to concentrate on the coast, because whilst large numbers of young Jews joined the British forces, but were largely employed on the service corps and transport, etc., there was every indication that if they had to take a convoy of 12 lorry loads of arms down to the desert, only 10 would go and 2 would be diverted up to the Jewish settlements. That was the sort of problem one had. And yet there's all this information is coming in, there's going to be a riot in the village or something wrong in such and such an area. None of our mounted patrols or anybody who's constantly out in the country, there's no indication whatsoever of Arab trouble in the hills, and nothing did happen. But they did have these Jewish terrorist activities building up in the coastal areas. And in Jerusalem, of course.
What did you personally feel about the drive to get more and more Jews into the country?
Well, it's difficult to say now, more than 50 years later. At that time, we couldn't see the grounds for it coming, the grounds from coming in. We realised that they were being squeezed by Hitler, but they couldn't see exactly why they had to come and take the Arab land and were causing all the trouble.
Because some people put the counter argument and say, well, the Arabs could always come in across the land frontiers from other Arab countries.
Well, I mentioned earlier on that casual labour in Jaffa, people came down from the Haran, they came down the orange picking season and then went back again. There was no real settlement in Palestine by Arabs from other countries, as far as I was aware. A certain number of casual Egyptian cooks and waiters would came up from Egypt and the Sudan to work in as domestic servants. But one must remember that in those pre-war years there wasn't a great deal of money about in the Middle East. There, for example, in the hill country of Samaria, around Nablus, some of the business people had managed to loan money to the peasant farmers, and then they get a certain proportion back, and then compel them to sell their olive crop, for example, to their particular factory and squeeze out the olive oil, or make soap from olive oil. But their money, they would then buy an orange grove on the coast, where the land is more fertile. But I've no recollection of any outsiders coming in and buying property. There were cases of Arabs who owned land in areas which the Jews wanted to buy, selling up and getting the hell out of the country, and spending on the high life of Beirut.
You mentioned Nablus. This was the area of the, I think it's called the Notorious Triangle.
Yes.
Why do you think that particular triangle of land was
well,
an area?
Well, they call it a triangle because you had Nablus, Tulkarm and Jenin as the three towns at the three points of what could be called a triangle. But it was all mountain country. And they were not particularly wealthy. There was a certain amount of subsistence farming to produce corn. And the main crop, as far as I recall, was from the olive crops, from olive trees. Not much else.
But why should it have been such a?
Well, because you had this mass unemployment and impoverished people, who could respond quickly to the religious agitation.
And it was purely Arab, was it?
Oh yes, entirely exclusively Arab at that time. Tulkarm was on the railway line, and between the railway line and the coast is a distance of not more than, I forget, was 9 kilometres or 9 miles. It's a very narrow strip, which is one of the arguments why the present Jewish government is so anxious to retain what they call the occupied territories. But the people of Tulkarm were able to see how the Jews were acquiring land and getting nearer and nearer to their own properties. And this place, Wadi Hawarith, I mentioned earlier, for evictions, was fairly close into Tulkarm. Jenin, on the other hand, was also on the borders of the plain of Esdraelon, which was being largely acquired by the Jews. Nablus was right in the heart of the mountain countries. It's in a cleft of a narrow valley with mountains more than 2,000 feet on either side of it going up. And it did exist from biblical times, pre-Christ. And various countries had it as their local centre of government, as a fairly large town. But it was a fact that the rural population was largely impoverished and could easily be recruited to take up rifles and do a spot of shooting.
Can we go on now to the post-war period, in the period of the Jewish guerrillas who were agitating for the formation of Israel? And can you tell me how that started, as far as you recollect?
Way back in 1895, 1897, Theodor Herzl, an Austrian Jew, was keen on starting Jewish settlements in Palestine, and that was encouraged more in during the First World War, when certain of the existing Jewish settlers acted as intelligence agents for the British Army, and some of the young people actually served with the Jewish battalion, the Royal Fusiliers, in the British Army. They were known jokingly, I believe, as the Jordan Highlanders. And things were going fairly smoothly for a number of years, but in 1929 there was a Jewish an outbreak of Arab terrorism when they attacked the Jews in Safed in the north, the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, and down in Hebron. And in Hebron they killed most of the Jews who didn't manage to get out of it, which is why in more recent years there was constant agitation in the Hebron area where the Jews have gone back in again. In 1935, as a result of Hitler's activities, Jewish immigration of young people started to build up very rapidly into Palestine. And this, because of the conditions in 36, the government started putting a clamp down the number of people who could come in legally each year. So underground cells of resistance people started to build up. But it wasn't until 1938, and I was in CID headquarters, I said to the head of the CID one occasion that I wasn't happy with what was happening. In the 6 months I'd been there, I'd only seen reports on Arab intelligence. It looked as though everybody got a one-track mind and they were paying no regard to what the Jews might be doing. So we formed a Jewish section to deal with Jewish political matters, and within 10 days the first reprisal took place from the Jewish side. An organization headed by a man called Abraham Ben Mordecai Stern, who was later killed in 1942. In about June 1939, a bomb was left in the main post office of Jerusalem, parcel, and one of our armourers chaps went along to examine it and was blown up and killed. At the 26th of August 1939, two of my colleagues were, one of them was the inspector in charge of the Jewish Affairs section, the other the Arab Affairs section, went for a Saturday lunchtime drink. On the way back to their mess, they were blown up by a terrorist bomb. And from then on, we were paying particular attention to what this terrorist group might be doing. They had a number of attempts at killing off British officers by either planting landmines near their homes or bombs under their cars. For example, the Deputy Inspector General in 1942 drove his car out of his compound in the German colony, and a parcel dropped away from him. His servant boy picked it up, went after him saying, "Master, you drop your parcel," and he picked up bits of the boy from the overhead telephone wires and things like that. That's the sort of thing which is going on. And that is why, and then in 1942, the officer in charge of the CID in Jaffa and Tel Aviv got information, and they managed to corner the head of this Jewish terrorist group, Abraham Mordecai Stern, and he was shot and killed. Then things were fairly quiet until March 1944. It so happened that on that particular, I was running an overflow training school at the time, and we used to send in about 30 men each evening on rest and recreation in a sort of large charabang affair. And this particular evening I'd been invited by a friend from UK who was serving the Royal Air Force to join him at the officers' club in Tel Aviv for dinner. So instead of letting this charabang go to his usual parking place, I said, "No, we'll stop somewhere else," which is more convenient to me because I was late. Only one man went back to the usual parking place, and he was shot and killed by Jewish terrorists. That same evening they put bombs outside the police headquarters in Jaffa, Tel Aviv and Haifa, and caused a lot of damage and killed a few more people. And from then on things really worked up. That is a group which is operated largely by Yitzhak Shamir and his people, the ones and previously by Menachem Begin, the one that's called the Irgun Svai Leumi.
How did their actions compare with what the Stern people had carried out?
It was the same sort of tactics: hit and run, park a bomb, or shoot somebody down from behind. Never a stand-up battle like our army was able to have with some of the Arab gangs. So it was very much a matter of luck as to who went round a corner and who saw the other side first.
How clever were they?
Oh, undoubtedly very clever, and they also had the solid support of the Jewish community. It was extremely difficult to get any information, or if something happened, nobody saw anything. One example of a murder in 1941 of a Jewish youth who had given some information to us, that's some people said, oh, we heard a shot and looked out the window and saw two people running away. One wasn't very tall and the other was shorter. You don't get very far on that. But there were two. That was a case in which the man had been shot by his own side for giving information. So it was very, very difficult to get information about them. We had two or three cases in which British policemen had memorised descriptions and photographs extremely well and picked out people who were in disguise, and then they themselves were shot down through having been good policemen. It wasn't a question of hatred. It just proved to be too efficient.
I think that you were near the King David Hotel.
Yes, I had been in charge of the Jerusalem Urban Division. And then I was due for leave at the beginning of August 1944. So I was temporarily moved out of replaced at headquarters and temporarily put onto the wireless control section. The reason was that at that particular period there were no fixed sailings of ships. So if a ship left Toulon to come back to Alexandria, there would be a signal, the ship is coming in, get your men down to Alexandria by a certain date. So everybody had to be available to move quickly. So I was just a spare file at the time at the control room. Well, the alarm went off and I went out to the hotel and found everything appeared to be perfectly normal. A number of extra police had turned out and all traffic had come to a standstill. And then I found out that a little Arab porter's barrow had blown up more or less opposite the offices of an Arab businessman who's known to have broken the boycott on trading with the Jews. And he said, oh, well, the bomb is over there, but I don't think it's directed at me. So I then moved across to the part of the King David which had blown up and spoke to a British corporal on sentry duty. He said, well, I just come on, but the Arab consul has been here, the Arab private has been here for about an hour. So I asked him, he said, oh, there's some shooting at the other end of the building. So I moved away from them and the bloody bomb went off and those two men were killed and I was blasted across the road and a total of 91 people were killed altogether. What had happened is that the Jews had come in disguised as Arabs with milk churns and got into the basement entrance to the restaurant and bar, tackled by a British army officer who had shot him down. They abandoned the bombs inside, but as a result of the shooting of this army officer, a British soldier working as a clerk in one of the offices saw these people running away and fired at them with his Sten gun and then went back to his desk. Actually, he'd fatally wounded one of them. We picked up the body and got the bullet out of him. But meanwhile, this little bomb which had gone off on the road was a distraction. They'd planted two of these Arab hawkers' barrows, one to each side of the King David Hotel, with incendiaries in them. The intention was for the bombs to go off, ignite the tarmac and prevent anybody or traffic getting in to the hotel from either side. One hadn't gone off, and the other only gone off at half cock. The reason for the attack on the King David Hotel was that it was the headquarters of the Palestine administration and the military headquarters. And I think this is the 22nd of July. Well, around about the 29th of June, on the Saturday, the police had raided the Jewish agency buildings in King George V Avenue, and that had caused the greatest indignation amongst all the Jews, because it was like raiding their home office and everything else. So it was a reprisal attack by the Jewish terrorists against the Palestine administration.
Which year was that?
1946.
What happened to you after you were blown across the...
Well, I was blasted across the road and picked myself up and tried to dust myself down, and it was a question of picking up casualties. I pick up two or three people and I stopped a car and forced the driver to take us to the hospital. He didn't want to go because the people were bleeding. As I got three casualties up to hospital, then I went back to the scene and found that it was really a job by then for the Royal Engineers and heavy equipment. So I was then sent up to the west side of the town, the road to Jaffa, Tel Aviv, to sort out the traffic tangle, because as a result of the sirens going off to stop all traffic, the only two-lane carriageway had been completely congested, and it took about 2 hours to sort them all out. You had to force certain people to reverse back to get a single line to disentangle from another road junction, etc. That's strange. I remember one incident I remember there was one Jewish lady speaking with an American accent, very nice, said, "When are you going to sort this lot out, officer? I haven't had any lunch." So I said, "Well, I'm very sorry, I haven't had any lunch either, and the blood of my uniform, some people will never have lunch again." No more comment.
Were you ever near any of the other infamous acts of violence at that time?
Yes, I think it was 46 that they attempted to blow up the offices of the Immigration Department, and I and my second in command at the time walked past this building, and the delayed action bomb went off and charged with dust and broken glass. And in July 1944, I went to the cinema, the old Eden Cinema, and I was sitting in the row just in front of a box occupied by the daughters of the then British High Commissioner, Sir Harold MacMichael. The elder girl, present Lady Aldington, whose husband was involved in that libel case recently. And we'd all just got nicely away from this cinema when the whole that corner of the building was blown up. Obviously, having the High Commission's party having gone to the cinema, somebody had tipped off the terrorists and they'd planted the bomb, fortunately just a shade too late. Then in end of September 1947, I'd been posted to Haifa, and early one morning about 9:30 a large barrel bomb was thrown over the security fence and rolled up against the police headquarters building, which caused a lot of damage and killed a couple of our chaps. They'd fixed up a lorry with like the davits on a ship for holding a lifeboat, and they cemented two 40 gallon oil drums together, filled an explosion. This thing had hurled the bomb over the top. There's a photograph in Lord Bethel's book. And that one. Well, it so happened that I was in bed at the time and heard the warning whistles blowing, and was just cursing the noise that was going on, and when the window of my room blew in across the bed. Fortunately, I hadn't got out. One young constable at the other side of the building got up and went to the window, and he was permanently blinded. And there were two others were killed. Then we had on the 31st of December 1947, there was an attempt on the refineries at Haifa. That each day there'd be a large number of Arab casual labourers would congregate outside the main gate to the oil refineries, hoping to get a day's work. And on this particular morning, a lorry drove by with two Jews in the back who threw a couple of grenades amongst a crowd of waiting Arabs, killed some and wounded others. The wounded were taken inside the refineries to the first aid station they had there and were being treated, and the news got round the Arabs workers that this had happened, and all hell was let loose. A total, I think, 47 Jews were killed. Well, my division headquarters about 5 kilometres away, and I'd left already and called the local station to tell that everybody had gone down to the refineries. And when I got there, I found the surviving Jews were all trapped in the mechanical workshops, with a number of Arabs that got inside. Was a sheet of the galvanised iron panelling had been ripped up, so I went in after them with some of the other chaps, and we managed to stop any more casualties and got the Jews out. Well, about 4 days later, we were having to escort the remaining Arab workers to and from work, and one evening the Jews ambushed the transport. No casualties occurred, and unfortunately the police escort vehicle, I don't know what they were doing, but they didn't get the traversing gadget on the armoured car working, so they didn't return the fire. Then the Jews decided to raid in a local Arab village, and they were beaten off. And the next thing, the Arabs came down to attack the local settlements, and so it was my station between the two. We had to go out with a crowd of chaps and do a little bit of shooting, long range fortunately. We eliminated one on the other side, and that's how it seemed to go on.
Did you ever come into close contact with the illegal immigration ships?
No, because it so happened that I was in the hill country, in Jerusalem and places like that. Even the when the Exodus came in, I think, was it 1947, or I'm not certain now whether it happened before I got to Haifa. I think it happened before I got there, but some 4,000 survivors from the so-called death camps were on the ship. It was intercepted, brought into Haifa, and then the British government decided to send everybody back to Germany, which caused international hoo-ha and much to do, and America threatening all sorts of things. So eventually Britain, realising what would happen if we allowed all these people into Palestine, referred the whole matter to the United Nations, saying we're only the mandatory power, what you want us to do, and they said, well, let the Jews in. So Britain said, well, we're giving up the mandate.
What were your feelings and those of your colleagues in the Palestine police when you heard that Britain was getting out of the mandate?
We found it very difficult to believe. We could not understand what was going on. Our people had moved out of Burma, evacuated India, and they were getting out of Palestine. Why are we getting out of everywhere? Remember, in those days, the World Service, the BBC, was about the sole international news we could pick up. It's very good, but limited. The only English language newspaper was the Palestine Post, now called the Jerusalem Post, which is more like a Jewish propaganda sheet and didn't really contain any international news. But as a result of this program run by the BBC or the ITV on Palestine, a former senior official of the Foreign Office indicated that it was due to American pressure on the British government, saying if you don't let the Jews into Palestine, we will cut you off from all aid and food supplies and everything else. So Britain was blackmailed into getting out. But that, I only learnt last year, 40 years later. But where we were, we couldn't understand why, as it happened that time, there's been a change of government, the socialist government. Is the socialist attitude just run away from everything? And we were particularly sore because, although many of us were ex-territorials or ex-regular soldiers, we'd not been allowed to go back into the forces during the war. We all had to stay in the police. In May 1942, when the retreat to El Alamein set in, we were all embodied into the Middle East Land Forces and given military ranks according to our stars or stripes, put in the Army Act for discipline, wear uniform 24 hours a day, armed at all times, and then suddenly when the war is over, we hadn't done anything particular, they suddenly say, well, you're not wanted. Well, how would you feel?
I think that you had a special...